Hi, and welcome to another episode of The Leadership Enigma. I'm excited for every episode, and I'm also pretty excited off the back of our recording of episode 200 last night, which will be available to you very soon. But I appreciate these episodes don't go out in sequence. But this one is a fascinating peek behind the curtain of a world no one has really thought about, a world you probably never visited, and that is the world of cathedral music. Have I got that right? I have got that right, haven't I? And how about this? I'm going to be speaking to a guest who is a woman who has broken into a man's world since, wait for it, 1209. Yes, you heard me right. Hundreds and hundreds of years of a man's world, but not anymore. Fascinated? Come back to me just after the break. Hi, I'm Adam Pacifico, and welcome to The Leadership Enigma, a world-ranked, award-winning podcast that's insatiably curious as regards what leaders do, how they do it, and importantly, why. We'll delve into the human doing, but even deeper into the human being and the power of human-centered leadership to drive sustainable change. So whether you're an entrepreneur, business owner, corporate executive, each week we speak to global experts, academics, rising stars, ambitious upstarts and disruptors, as together we will discover that success leaves clues. Sarah, it's a huge warm welcome to the Leadership Enigma. How are you?
I'm very well, and thank you very much for having me.
I hope I have piqued people's interest in relation to what on earth is he talking about? When we first met, I was fascinated by who you are, what you do, why you do it. There are just so many questions. We have to start from the beginning. Just tell everybody the role that you have at the moment.
Okay, I am the director of music at Selwyn College, Cambridge. And I also run the girl choristers at Ely Cathedral. And I am the university organist for the University of Cambridge. And actually, by the time this goes out, I will also be president of the Royal College of Organists.
Which is a pretty high accolade, isn't it?
Yeah.
We'll come on to.
Yeah.
I know even you are deeply chuffed. I know you're very humble as well, but I will ask you about that. I introduce this as a peek behind the curtain of a world that, let's be honest, most people have never seen or heard. I'll change my mind. Not seen, but heard. And we're talking about cathedral music, yes?
Yes.
Just help us understand, what do we mean by cathedral music?
So first of all, we mean the choirs and the organs and all of that sort of music that is part, a daily part of the cathedral tradition here in the UK in particular. And also extends to kind of big parish churches where there's a choir and tradition like that. I think they're called greater parish churches or major parish churches. And definitely to the Oxbridge chapels and the traditions that have gone on there since the founding of those two universities. And also obviously to places like Westminster Abbey and the Royal Chapels Royal and that aren't actually cathedrals. But
yeah.
And the thing I think people need to think about is that actually, especially last year, obviously, but they do see these things all the time. It's very much part of the kind of public consciousness of this place, of this country. But it was absolutely massively on display for that tradition, for the funeral of Her Late Majesty and also for the coronation. And obviously, the other thing that people think of as just normal tradition is King's College, Cambridge, at Christmas. Everyone watches it on TV, watches the carols from King's, and then listens to the broadcast live on Radio 4. And it's part of the public consciousness without people realizing it. But it's a very, very small niche world, despite being that kind of important.
You explained it so much better, Sarah. That's why I love doing these episodes. You're right, it is a real niche. And I'm glad you mentioned that. So we talked about funerals, coronations, Christmas time. So whilst we were talking about maybe a unique tradition within the UK, this is global, because I can imagine that millions of people tuned into those events and tune into Christmas at King's. So again, it's a global audience who are probably thinking, I haven't really thought about it before, but you're right.
Yep.
I'm watching and I'm listening to the cathedral music, which in some ways might be taken for granted.
Absolutely.
How on earth do you get into this?
Well,
how did a Canadian-born lass get into this world?
Yeah, that's a good question. I sometimes ask myself, if I'm honest.
It's too late now.
Yeah. So I mean, my family are musical, and I grew up in the Anglican Church of Canada. I wasn't allowed to sing in the choirs of the churches we went to, the cathedrals in particular, because I was female. Right. My dad and my brothers were allowed to sing because there were men and boys choirs.
But, a man's world, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. So I went a kind of other direction. I was a solo pianist, and I got really interested whilst I was studying piano after school. So I was at the conservatory in Toronto, kind of doing full time. Really interested in conducting, and I thought to myself, now, I know I wasn't allowed to sing in those choirs, but I wonder whether anyone would object if I stood in front and conducted. And it turned out that they didn't. Lord only knows why, but anyway. So
no
I,
pun intended.
No, exactly. So I took up the organ quite late because they sort of go hand in hand, organ, choral conducting. It's, you know, that sort of liturgical
that
role.
That genre.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And I then came on a summer course in the UK with lots of students. They're run by the Rodolphus Foundation for students who like this kind of music. And suddenly realized that there were more jobs. There was more opportunity here because obviously Canada's it's a huge country, but there's a very small population. And we're sort of a kind of provincial outpost of the tradition here, whereas it's absolutely at its heart in the UK.
Right.
And so I came as an overseas undergraduate to Cambridge as an organ scholar basically never left.
The rest is history almost, isn't it? There we go. So Cambridge got their hooks into you and they never let you go. Did you know you could make a career out of this? Did you hope?
I guess I hoped and I knew it was more likely here. Yeah, because there are more. I mean, Cambridge is an interesting one. You know, it's a small world, but there are probably 25 positions for people like me in Cambridge, whereas there are probably 25 positions like this in the whole country of Canada.
Right.
So actually, it's not that I couldn't do this job there, but there's more opportunity and it's more concentrated here.
Right. So. Tell us a little bit about the history, because this really has been the domain of the men, hasn't it? I mentioned a date there of 1209. I think we also talked about 1670. So we're really talking historical dates now.
Yeah.
Can you help us with a little bit of a history lesson as to why it's been that way for so long and just help us understand?
Sure. Well, first of all, in the cathedral tradition and therefore by extension in Oxbridge chapels, the people that, you know, the priests were male, the singers were male, boys, the boy choristers were male, the male lay clerks, the adults who sing in the back row were male. In Cambridge, all the students were male until the late 19th century. And there were two colleges then founded in the late 19th century, which were specific to women. But, that was 800 years after the university had been founded.
Right.
And in fact, there are still two colleges in Cambridge that are entirely female. Traditionally, you know, it was sort of based on a monastic model, I suppose.
Yes.
And so everything was male and the communities were male. And of course, there was some of this kind of music going on for women, but only in convents.
Right.
It's sort of overlooked. People are starting to write PhDs on that sort of thing, though. There's a lot of very good, Italian Renaissance polyphony, sort of the same kind of time as composers like Palestrina, which everybody's heard of. And there's all kinds of composers, female composers, music written for the monastery, the convents in which they lived and worked. But nobody had found out about it until about 15 years ago, basically. Then Cambridge and the cathedral tradition carried on being male for a long, long time, just historically. And actually, it was only about 30 years ago that there have been sort of, it's like anything, it's a slightly messy history, but the first really full-time top row of girl choristers,
yes,
which was founded at Salisbury Cathedral,
right,
was 1992, I believe. And that's the first time you had
girls
singing in the cathedral at the same, you know, on the same sort of basis as
what
boys.
What brought that change on? Do you know?
Well, a director of music, Richard Seal, who sort of said,
I knew you'd know the answer.
Yeah, exactly. This is this phenomenal education. You know, kids get, I mean, yes, they get free musical education, but crucially, they learn unbelievable life skills at a very young age, because of course boys have to do this before their voices change. So they're basically professional singers by the age of 13, and they get this because they're doing this every day. And Richard Seal thought, there's 51% of the population out there who's not allowed to do this. except in a couple of corners. St. David's Cathedral in Wales was doing it. Leicester Cathedral was doing it, but they were doing it. It was not quite so intense as this kind of full-time experience.
Okay.
So, and now nearly every cathedral has girls in some form or other.
So that was a sea change
moment, or
a catalyst.
Yeah.
And you are breaking boundaries. So you're currently the director of music, as you said, at Cambridge.
At Selwyn College.
At Cambridge. An organist.
Yes.
What are you looking after? Kind of what does your portfolio include in that role?
So at Selwyn, I am responsible for the chapel choir, which sings three services every week.
Right.
Again, along the sort of monastic foundation. I mean, it wasn't monastic. It was a 19th century Anglo-Catholic foundation, really.
Okay.
But therefore sort of set up with this intention that, you know, that it's required by the statutes of the college that services are said every day during full term in the chapel. And so we sing them three times a week. It used to be every day, but undergraduates have degrees to do these days. So, you know.
Okay.
So that's one thing. I'm also responsible for making sure that there's a concert series and that those are student run, but I kind of oversee them and make sure they do run them. My other role in Cambridge, apart from a bit of, I do some undergraduate teaching and examining, but is that of university organist, which we don't know exactly when it was founded, but the first record of somebody called organist to the University of Cambridge is 1670.
Right.
And I am the first woman ever to hold that role. And for that, I am responsible for providing music for university occasions. So the one that's coming up soon is, that's the biggest kind of, I guess, ceremonial event in the university calendar, which is the honorary degree day, which is entirely conducted in Latin. So that all the speeches and everything
this
are in Latin.
Ceremony, tradition, history.
Yeah. And it's a day that the tourists love it because everyone is in all of their full kind of Edwardian and, you know, university regalia, and you have to wear the right clothes and the right, you know.
We do pomp and ceremony rather well in the UK.
Indeed.
And also, let's talk about it, you know, Oxbridge, you know, certainly both of them will do that very well too. Can I just ask this? What's the role of religion in all of this? Because obviously this is hand in glove in how you're describing it. But how did that come about? Or was it always just that way?
Well, I guess the thing is that it's a kind of historical thread. I mean, all of these choirs began their, you know, the cathedral choirs, college choirs, etc., began their existence you know, thousands of years ago as a group of religious, you know, monks or nuns in, you know, whatever. And, you know, the thing that they do is pray every day. And they prayed back, you know, pre-Reformation, they prayed seven times every day.
Right.
You know, or was it nine even, whatever. You know, then every 3 hours they went to church and did
I'm
going to
rely
you know,
on your answers. Yeah.
and all of those, what were called offices, so, you know, you do your morning prayer and your midday prayer and blah, blah, they all had, you know, music associated with them. And, you know, it's just sort of gradually, you know, I guess morphed over 1,000 years from being you're going to sing the Psalms, you know, 7, 8, 9 times a day to now it's 3 times a week because everyone's busy. I mean, I suppose in monasteries, they do still do it 7 times a day, you know. But that's the kind of tradition. And the thing about it now, of course, is especially a place like Cambridge, you know, it's not a secular university because its foundations are very much religious, and it does have the word religion in the university statutes and in the statutes of most of the colleges.
Right.
But they are communities of all faiths and none. And you don't have to be a card carrying anything to sing in the choir.
Right. Okay.
And that's really important. And people,
might make that mistake, mustn't they? That there has to be a certain religious belief or level.
I mean, we try and make sure that people know that's not the case. And
right.
we, you know, everywhere it says this is a community of all faiths and none, and, you know, everyone's welcome. And,
right.
you know, and I don't know whether the message gets across or not, but we are wearing cassocks and surplices. So we look like a church choir because in essence, that's what we are. But I know I've got, you know, agnostics and Roman Catholics, and I've had Orthodox Jews and, you know, in the choir. And actually what they have to know that they're leading an act of Anglican worship, because that's what the statutes of the college require.
Yes. And it's so probably rather obvious,
you know,
to them as
well. Yeah, exactly. So you're not going to want somebody who's going to, you know, turn around during the creed and scream, I don't believe this, because that would be unhelpful. But actually, whether they do or not is not really my business. They just commit to, you know, continuing the musical tradition and the kind of, not service with what we offer for the college on behalf of the college, you know, and it is a space that that a lot of them, I mean, it's interesting, it's exam term right now. And I know that there are lots of students who actually, they don't come to chapel because they think, I haven't got time. But what they do is they put our webcast, because we live stream everything since the pandemic, and they'll put Evensong on.
Oh, how times have changed since 1670, Sarah. Okay, so people can actually log in and watch
absolutely.
And watch the stream.
Yep.
That's fascinating then, isn't it? That it's almost in some ways religious agnostic, but it is part of a religious ceremony. So,
exactly.
So that's an interesting one. Let's talk about the role that you're about to take on. Because this is very exciting, isn't it?
It is.
Now, I'm going to try and get this right, and then you can tell me what I've got wrong. You're about to become the president of the Royal College of Organists.
That's right.
And that's 160 years old, isn't it?
It is.
And you are the first...
I'm the third woman.
Third woman in that role.
Believe it or not.
Okay.
Yes.
But it's the most... it's the most senior role in the world.
Probably from a prestige point of view, yeah.
Wow.
That is quite
And
exciting.
It's rather ceremonial.
Yeah.
Okay, tell us about it. Come on,
okay.
Sarah.
Well...
I did my best. But
So I am the third woman to hold it.
Right.
The first woman was 1994, actually, way back in the dark ages, the Dame Gillian Weir. I mean, you know, she's one of the world's most famous organists, whether she's a woman or not. The fact that she's Dame for being an organist. And then the wonderful Catherine Ennis, who was president in the sort of mid-noughties. Actually, she died a couple of years ago, which was very sad because she was very young. Anyway, what it is, it's the Royal College of Organists was the first sort of dedicated. It's not a union, but it's kind of like a musician's union for organists, and you know it's a kind of professional body basically, and they do exams and they offer diplomas and qualifications for young organists. Well, organists of any age can sign up to do the diplomas and stuff. And there are events. There's a major education and outreach sort of event program, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
It was founded, 2014 was its 150th. So, yeah, that makes it 160, doesn't it?
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, I can do the maths.
It's quite a...
and, you know, I look back on the list of the people that have held this presidential role, and it includes some sort of icons of this profession, like Sir David Wilcox and Sir Stephen Cleaverry, and composers Harold Dark and Herbert Howells and Edward Berstow, and like sort of names that are...
You sound surprised that you're about to do this.
I am. And
How did this happen, Sarah?
The sort of presidential tap on the shoulder. I had to pick my jaw up off the ground every day for about 3 weeks.
It's incredibly exciting.
Yeah.
So you'll step into this role when?
On Canada Day, appropriately.
There's a slight irony there, isn't
which
there?
Which is the 1st of July.
Okay. And what will change for you when you move into that role?
Well, it is primarily a ceremonial role,
yep.
Which is good because I wouldn't have time to do much more than that. But I think I will, I've already written my first presidential appeal letter and sort of, you know.
Who's that go to?
It goes to all the members.
Right.
And when it comes out, I'll probably... you know, put it on my own social media and stuff so people can read it. Because it's a little bit of a...
Is it your manifesto?
It is a bit of a manifesto, yeah.
Okay.
And it's about something that's quite dear to all of our hearts at the moment, which is the need for valuing music as a concept and as a profession, and valuing musical education, which has been absolutely slashed over the past 10 years, such that you'll get huge numbers of pupils in schools who have absolutely no music after the age of 13, and even it's just, you know, whereas it should be a core subject. But
what's music meant to you in your life?
Well, it's funny because, of course, for me, I mean, some people will say, well, it's a great pastime, or it's something that I really love to listen to. But for me, of course, it's a bit of an obsession because I sort of say,
which your livelihood,
yeah,
isn't
exactly,
it?
Exactly. It's and people say, people who are not musicians, I think, often think it's, you know, being a musician or being a dancer or being an artist or something like that is sort of a vocation of some sort. And I would say, in my description, is not really a vocation for those of us who have no choice. It's more like an addiction. And, you know, that's quite a strong word, but actually exactly. I was put here on this earth to make music. And I'm fortunate that I've also been able to, you know, pay my rent with it.
Yeah.
Because that's not always the case for some. And, you know, but, you know, really simple things like being a composer. What does that mean? I just love pushing notes around on the page until they make the patterns that I want them to make, you know, and that comes out as music. And then people sing that music and, you know.
Do you feel you're living your purpose?
Yes, absolutely.
Because
absolutely.
That's what I get when I listen to you. But you also just mentioned composing. Just help everyone understand that element too.
So I do a lot of composition, particularly of choral and organ music. I think one of the things that's changed even just, I mean, just in the past 5 or 6 yeah. years, if you look back at, you know, if you look at any cathedral, you can look at a music list, you know, all the music that gets sung at the daily choral services. And until about 5 or 6 years ago, I would say 98% of it was by men.
Right.
Some places would do living composers, but they would be men. And a lot of places, it's just dead men, okay. You know, and dead white men as well. And I love dead white men. They're great. And I love their music. But actually, what's been amazing, there's sort of change, particularly in the past 5 or 6 years, is this suddenly people are interested and keen to discover what I was saying earlier about the music by Renaissance nuns, which has, you know, been abandoned in a conventicle, you know, in an archive somewhere, and right. just being rediscovered, and people saying, "Wow, this is great." But also contemporary female composers, and there are a number of us. The thing about being a choral composer is that if you get a piece of music into the repertoire of a cathedral choir, say a set of a Magnificat and Nunc Dimittis, which they have to sing a setting of every single day.
Right.
If you get it into the repertoire of a cathedral choir, you'll get lots and lots of performances of it. Unlike, you know, somebody's first symphony or whatever, and they might get one performance, and then you're like desperate for the second performance. I mean, I've written a set of canticles, that's the Magnificat and Nunc Dimittis, which are, you know, must be sung by every single day as part of choral evensong, which is sung all over the world at least probably once or twice a week. Somebody says, "Oh, we sang this of yours," and that's actually that's kind of a nice thing, you know. And the irony is that if it's sung in the context of public worship, we don't get any royalties for
that. That was my next question. What's the commercial reality of
this?
It's almost like you're writing lyrics and they're being played on the radio every day.
How does this work? If they get played on the radio or in a concert where there's a fee paying, well, even if it's not fee paying, but if there's a retiring collection thing, if it's a concert, then PRS is relevant.
What's PRS?
So Performing Rights Society. And I get, you know, little dribs and drabs from people who've recorded my music.
Right.
It's not very much. You know, I can buy myself.
Well, it's like writing a book, isn't
it? Exactly.
No one's going to retire.
Exactly.
Unless it's the outline.
Yeah.
Okay, so there is a commercial element to
but,
it.
Yes, and you get money if you've had it published. And, you know, the thing that's good about it is that, unlike a book, most people don't just buy one. My set of canticles, when Choir X wants to do it, they have to buy 35 copies because they're 35 human beings in Choir X. So, but I mean, it's not a huge amount in terms of royalties. But there's a little bit of it.
But it's also recognition, isn't it?
Yeah,
nice to know that it's being used and enjoyed.
Exactly.
And celebrated and shared.
Yeah, so that's right.
I'm sure.
And, you know, there are some composers who make a proper living doing it. For me, it's just a little bit of extra cash. Every once in a while, I buy myself a gin and tonic. And, you know, so.
Nothing wrong with that, with it. I mean, how does it feel to be a bit of a trailblazer then? Because as a female in what has been a man's world for hundreds and hundreds of years... How's that feel?
It's funny. I don't really think about it because I'm still doing it. But I know...
But you're a role model.
Well, I didn't set out to be. It's kind of accidental.
But you are.
But
the reality is...
I think that's probably true. And I think, you know, if I've inspired, you know, girls or boys, for heaven's sake, you know, anyone to think, actually, this is, you know, I've fallen in love with this music and this way of life and I really actually want to be able to do this every day. Yeah. If I've inspired some of my students or my choristers or whatever to do that, then I've succeeded.
Well, I talk to leaders all the time, leaders of businesses, small, medium, large, people who are in figurehead or ambassadorial roles, which is very much what you're... Mm. That is a role model position. Do you think it will change you slightly? Or do you think you'll need to adapt slightly, knowing that you are in a high-profile ceremonial.
I might proofread things on social media a little bit more carefully.
The joys of social media.
You know, every once in a while you put something up and, you know, you sort of don't worry about it if it has a typo in it. But I think if I'm doing stuff publicly all the time, I better double check.
But you're still you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the other things that's important is that actually, you know, even, you know, a sort of public post about something, I need to be careful about it. You know, if I write a piece for a journal or an article for a newspaper or something, it probably get sense-checked, I guess, by the PR people and stuff. And that's actually a good thing.
Yeah.
In fact, the first one I've written, they sent a draft to me and I sort of adjusted it and stuff. And it was a bit like, I think it must be like having a speechwriter.
speechwriters sat where you're sat as well, which is good. What do you hope you'll achieve with the role? And you're very much in the role, but what do you hope is going to be your legacy in this niche world as you continue to trailblaze in the industry, but also for women in this industry?
That's a good question. I guess I think the legacy that I would like to leave eventually when I retire from any of my positions, I would like to leave a legacy of human beings who have fallen in love with making music.
Okay.
And, you know, there's so much intensity about achieving music at an elite level. You know, just like there is an elite gymnast or an elite tennis player or something, you know, the world doesn't have any, especially this country, doesn't have any problem with elite sports people. We're proud of our elite sports people.
Right.
Whereas the world at the moment is afraid of elite music making. Then this country is afraid of the elite choral
tradition.
Tell me,
what do you mean by that?
Well, because, you know, they think it's, you know, it's exclusionary or, you know, it's establishment and not everyone can join in. Whereas I suppose you could find somebody who eventually becomes an elite footballer, you know, on a council estate somewhere. To be honest, one of the things that's amazing about choristership is if we are allowed to get out there into the schools and find these kids, we will find brilliant young singers at the age of 7 who actually can come to the... I mean, I've got a Ukrainian refugee in my girls' choir at Ely Cathedral right now.
Right.
You know, and that's... She's a really brilliant young singer. And finding the... So it's not elite, but the discipline that we demand and the skill level and the performance level is elite. And that's a good thing. And we need to be proud of it.
Now, I think that's fascinating, isn't it? Because if you think about it and how we've described it, in some ways I've walked into this. We're talking about royal weddings, coronations, Christmas at King's, Oxford, Cambridge, cathedrals. We are talking about what people will see as an exclusive and elite world.
Absolutely.
Open to very, very few. But I think what you're saying is that's not true.
No, it's not true. It's open to the people who Oxford and Cambridge, they are open to anybody who is brilliant and hardworking. Now, that's not to say that everybody in the country who is brilliant, or every 17-year-old in the country who is brilliant and hardworking is going to get in, because they're not massive. And that's hard. But we go absolutely out of our way to find those people. Now, they didn't 60 years ago, you know, but we are going out of our way to find them now. And it is an incredibly diverse community. What is not diverse is the elite striving towards excellence that Cambridge undergraduates and Oxford undergraduates
That's
are.
That's the non-negotiable piece,
exactly.
Isn't it? So how do you go about, in some ways, busting the myth that this is an absolutely closed elite, and for many, still think male environment?
Yeah.
So it's a very select few who will ever go near it. How do you, as in your role as president now, Sarah, how do you go about busting that?
I don't know, because it takes a long time for these sorts of myths to be busted.
Yeah.
Even really simple things. Now,
maybe that's your legacy.
You know, maybe it is. I don't know whether I can achieve that as president of the RCO in 2 years. You know, maybe I can eventually. But you'd be surprised at how long it takes what Joe Bloggs out there thinks is the case to change. I mean, just a very personal example of this was earlier, last month now. I did a Radio 3 live choral evensong broadcast with my choir at Selwyn.
Right.
Now, I've been at Selwyn for 25 years, just marked that last weekend. The choir has been very good for, I hope, at least 22 of those years. You know, I mean, I had a little bit of building to do when I arrived, but actually, you know, the foundations were in place from my predecessors. And
Right.
You know, we've been broadcasting live for some, for a couple of years. We have done, I've made 20 commercial CDs with them. And one of the things about the live Radio 3 thing is I think there are some people out there who are, they're a bit like kind of train spotters. They go to wherever it's being broadcast from in order to say that they were there at the live broadcast. Now, it's broadcast every Wednesday. It's the BBC's longest outside broadcast, you know, program. It's been it's nearly 100 years old. And there was a couple there that I didn't know. They came to Selwyn Chapel to be there whilst we broadcast live. They could have sat in their living room and listened to it. But anyway, it was nice that they came, and that was great. The chap came up to me afterwards and said, I had no idea that Selwyn College had a choir at all, let alone one this good. So, I mean, how, you know, and it's true. King's and John's have choirs that people have heard of, King's and St. John's at Cambridge. And maybe those who know a little bit about the mixed choral tradition might know that Trinity College has a very good choir.
Right.
And there are one or two others that have been good for a little bit longer than I've been around. But 25 years I've been trying. And so I don't know how long it takes.
So there's going to be a lot of pavement pounding, I think, Sarah, in relation to spreading the word. Social media, I think that's your way forward. Listen, I want to ask you, what does it feel like? Because I know you have had many students who are part and parcel of your world and you're contributing to their development. And you have actually seen your students on TV, haven't you?
I have.
Because tell us a little bit about that and how that felt.
Well, it was particularly in during the 10 days of national mourning for Her Late Majesty.
Yes.
And the services in Wales and in Belfast that the now King and Queen went to in those 10 days.
Yes.
The organists were both former students of mine. And at the committal service in St. George's, Windsor, the organist before the service was a former student of mine.
Wow.
And it was very odd to be not just, I mean, it's been a while now that I've known people on those sorts of events. And, you know, they're colleagues or they're friends or whatever. But actually to have my own students responsible for such extraordinarily important moments in the national, in national history.
Pressure.
You know, yeah. But it made me incredibly proud.
What's been your favourite event that you have played a part in, or a standout event for you, and why? Out of so many. What one just kind of?
I guess. I mean, there's a few things.
Okay. What do you think?
My very first outing as university organist was putting on the. Being responsible for the music for the university's official memorial service for the Duke of Edinburgh. And by that, of course, I mean Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh.
Yep.
And because, of course, he'd been our chancellor for a long time. So the university did an official service, and that was my very first appearance.
That's
in
a hell
that
of
role.
A first appearance.
Yeah, exactly. that was an honour.
Yeah.
Just last weekend, as I say, we marked my 25th anniversary at Selwyn, and I had over 150 of my former choir members come back. That's by far the majority of them.
Oh, that must have tugged at the heartstrings, right?
That was amazing.
Right.
Yeah.
Dry eye?
Because I had to keep it dry, but yeah.
But probably quite difficult to do that. Tell me a little bit of kind of what lessons have you taken from being in this world, striving to succeed, being one of only a few females in a very male-dominated world, in a world that is perceived to be highly exclusive. What kind of lessons have you taken away now that you'll take into your president's role?
I think one of the things, I mean, I think this is partly a personality trait in me, but I am acutely aware of never being complacent with what I have achieved. Partly because it could always be better.
Are you a perfectionist?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
No hesitation there.
I think that's, you know, that's also the mark of someone elite. And, you know, you could just listen to, Roger Federer after a tennis match, and he'll tell you what went wrong in the third set. And you're like, that was the most astonishing thing we've ever seen in our lives, right? Yeah. And he'll still say, well, yes, but I missed that particular serve or whatever. And that's absolutely how somebody who is, you know, that's how I operate. So something might have been utterly amazing, but I'll still say, oh, well, that wasn't quite good enough. And, you know, so, but I think, but the other thing is that especially as not a minority, but you know what I mean, the sort of underrepresented non-establishment member of the profession, I did not just walk into, you know, anything, the sort of, The, the people who just walk into having a, I don't have a manager, for example. And, you know, I think that's partly my generation. And it's a lot to do with being female because right. I'm not really a sort of superstar marketable person. So I have to do all that stuff myself. And so I'm consciously working and striving for making things as good as I can and maintaining things. And I'm always aware of what's going on around, making sure that what I have built continues. Which
you're
makes
highly
it hard.
Driven, but where's that come from?
My mother.
Right, tell me more. Come on, there's always something in the background there. Tell me more.
Well, my parents are both pretty overachievers as well, but my mum especially, who was a singer, a professional singer. Okay. And you know, she would sort of be in the kitchen and she'd shout out, I think that's an F sharp in bar 12.
So, but let me ask you, how do you manage your focus on perfectionism when you've got your students who are trying to learn and experiment and getting things wrong?
I was less good at that early in my career than I am now.
So how do you manage maybe your natural proclivity to perfectionism and students who are learning and need to feel safe to get it wrong?
Well, they're all very happy for them to get it wrong in rehearsal as long as it's right in the performance.
I'm starting to feel under pressure now, sir.
But actually, seriously, I think, you know, I have two different sides of that because I work with two very different choirs. So my choir in Cambridge is full of undergraduate Cambridge students who actually they themselves are desperate to get things as good as they possibly can. Now, quite frankly, that might be in chemical engineering rather than music, but they have that side of them.
Yes.
And in the end, the ones that I think, even if they're nervous about it, I had a girl who sang a big solo the other day who was really nervous about it and was getting things wrong in the rehearsal.
Yes.
And I thought she didn't need to be. I thought she was getting things wrong in the rehearsal because she was nervous about it rather than because she wasn't capable of doing it.
Right.
And I pushed her. And we had an extra little practice just before the service. And then she absolutely nailed it because she was so determined. And I can do that with a Cambridge student. Now, with my year four girls in Ely, that would be less appropriate. Okay. I've got to take it much more at that, you know, because they're little. And, you know, I still expect a particular standard. And I will, you know, if one of the older girls, you know, does something, makes a big mistake in the service or whatever, I will just catch their eye and sort of go, and then, you know, they know perfectly well.
Were you that teacher that we were all frightened of?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I'm getting flashbacks now, I really
sorry.
Am.
Sorry, triggering.
I want to ask just a couple more questions because let's think about the organ is probably not an instrument that many people know of, have heard, but how on earth do you get people interested? Because I know have you got a campaign to try and get kids interested at school to play the organ?
Yes, well, we're just about to launch Play the Organ Year.
Tell me about that.
Play the Organ Year 2025.
Right.
And the idea is to get people to actually sit down at an organ console and find out what it's like. I mean, it's like driving a plane, you know. I mean, you sort of got your feet going and your hands going, you've got buttons. It is very like the console of a you know, kind of a plane or whatever. The Royal College of Organists has been putting digital organs into schools because, of course, they you know, there are pianos everywhere. I mean, if you go to Heathrow and there's a piano in every departure
King's
lounge,
Cross,
right? Yeah, exactly,
on the
exactly.
Concourse, couple of
you know, and that's
there.
That's a relatively recent thing, but it's a great thing. People can just sit down and do whatever they like.
Yeah,
that's less obvious with an organ, and they. But it's interesting that there are more decent digital organs since the pandemic, because all the churches were closed. Don't get me started about that. But it did mean that anyone who was actually an organist, if they wanted to do any practice, had to buy a practice organ. And so there are a lot more of them. And they have, you know, therefore, the companies that are building them, they've got better at it. They're building better instruments. They used to be a kind of, you know, they were not terribly reliable. And they only went in parish churches where people didn't know what they were doing or whatever. But now you can actually get fairly reasonable instrument. It's still not a proper organ. It's not a pipe organ where you've actually got the wind and you know, sort of. But
they're complex.
They are incredibly
tools,
complex.
Aren't they?
Yes.
Now, I know there's more of this on social media, isn't there? Because I think people are intrigued in relation to, that is a complex piece of...
Absolutely. And there are a few players who are, you know, I mean, Anna Lapwood is the obvious one.
Yeah.
He's a friend of mine, you know. But there are a number of others who have surprisingly large followings. And just sort of because you watch someone. I mean, I started quite late as an organist and I was a skilled pianist when I started. And of course, the keyboards that you use.
Well, just help us understand the complexity of the instrument.
So piano, we get. Yeah, but what you have to do, you've also got a keyboard for your feet.
Yes.
And then you've also got stops. Where, you know, you pull the stops out, and that's what makes the noise. And of course, pulling out all the stops, everyone knows that phrase. That means let's have everything going. That comes from the organ because you pull out all the stops, and that's how it makes the most noise.
That's where it's from.
Absolutely.
That's great.
But the really, when I started learning, I mean, anyone who's ever tried to sit down, who plays the piano, has tried to sit down an organ. The main thing you know that is incredibly difficult, no matter how coordinated you are, is to make your left hand and your feet go in opposite directions at the same time as each other. And that, and it's extraordinary how hard that was. That's the difficult skill when you're first learning.
Wow, how long did it take you to transition from being a great pianist to a good organist?
I would say it took me probably about 10 or 12 years before I was really comfortable at the organ.
Really, after being a fantastic pianist?
Yeah, I mean, I could do anything that was manuals only, so hands only. I was like totally fine, but just feeling like, you know, physically comfortable. But I still feel, I think I am, I mean, I'm a fellow of the Royal College of Organists. I have the highest qualification you can get for that. It still feels like my second instrument. Like, it's like I'm completely fluent in a second language, but it's still my second language, and my mother tongue is the piano.
Right, wow. So you kind of always, you may revert to type.
And I went, interestingly, during the lockdown, I didn't go out and buy a digital organ. I did have access to Selwyn College Chapel, and the chapel was closed, but the college was open to those who couldn't leave.
Do you live on site?
So I would take my daily exercise, and I would go and practice the organ. but I did actually, at home I have a piano, and I did revert to type. I went back to my roots as a pianist, and actually my first solo recording, which is the product of the lockdown, is being released a week today.
So. Wow, we've timed this very well, haven't we? There's a lot going on, I tell you what, in your life right now, especially after the 25th anniversary. This has been an amazing peek behind the curtain into a niche world. Yes, it's a topic I knew nothing about until I was introduced to you by Matt, so there's a shout out to Matt for making this happen as well. I hope he's listening or watching. Let me ask you this: what's kind of the best piece of leadership advice that you have ever given or received in all that you've done? Is there something that comes to mind?
I don't know if I've specifically been told leadership advice, but I have learned it. Through this experience, and I've observed good leadership and not so good leadership. So I think in my specific role, the leadership that I have shown, I hope, is simply being the best that I can be at this job. And if that means that others try to emulate that, either by, you know, by being the best at they as they can be in whatever their field, then, you know, when they leave my choirs or whatever, they know they can see what achieving excellence is. Then that, I hope, because I think that is being an example of excellence.
The role model piece,
is a role
isn't
model.
It,
but I've also watched I'll tell you something. You can edit this out if you like, but I'll tell you somebody who might be interesting.
These
for
are always
you
the
to,
best bits, yeah. Sarah.
So. Somebody that might be interesting for you to interview, who for me has been an extraordinary model of leadership, is actually the master of Selwyn College, who is about to retire. And he came, he had an Oxford degree, but he'd been a BBC executive before coming to Selwyn, so he wasn't in an academic. He spent the first year in his role going to supervisions, going to lectures, sitting in on admissions interviews, and observing quietly, seeing how the place ran.
Mm.
And then in the second year, he slowly and quietly started to make his mark, and always leading by consensus. And as he's looked towards retirement a year from now, he has just slowly, so he's been in post for nearly 15 years, but he has slowly extricated himself from things and just allowed succession to carry on. And I think he's been an extraordinary model of
There's
that.
There's a
of
humility
leadership.
In that, isn't there?
Absolutely. And I hope, at this point in my life, I can't see, I don't know, but I hope eventually when I'm looking towards retirement that I will be in a position to announce that early enough that I can step back slowly from things rather than holding on for dear life and then running away and hoping,
you role modeling him just as students are role modeling you. So that's what I'm hearing. You can't retire just yet because you've just got this role and you've got lots to do. Listen, Sarah, thank you so much for coming in and having a chat on the Leadership Enigma. I hope this has been fun.
It has been. Absolutely.
The studio is pretty cool, right?
It is very cool.
We're having a good week on the podcast, that's for sure. Listen, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And I'm off to Cambridge University tonight.
Excellent. We'll have an excellent time.
It's a small world. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Join us again next week for more curiosity and insight with the Leadership Enigma. We'd love to hear your comments on today's show, as well as suggestions for future topics and guests. Get in touch with me on LinkedIn or visit us at www.leadersenigma.com. Don't forget to rate, review and subscribe on all your major podcast platforms and on our dedicated YouTube channel. Thanks again for joining the community.